Hello, Adam. And how are you? But actually, not how are you. How does your perfect Saturday begin?
Well, I wake up at the same time every morning.
It's impressive.
Yeah, I'll read for about an hour. Right now, I'm reading A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles. Mm-hmm. I'll make myself a coffee, check emails, even though it's a Saturday. I'll also look at the sign-up numbers for my health program on adamsmith2ms.health.
Oh, I didn't know you had that. That's a good plug, though. What do you do next when you've done all of that?
Well, I work out 5 days a week. So,
very good.
Yeah, I'm down at the gym half an hour before it opens. They let me in earlier. So I have a swim and have the sauna to myself. Then I'll review my to-do list while walking on the treadmill. No sweating.
Do you just decide not to sweat?
No
or
sweating.
You just don't
sweat?
Yeah. Right, okay, well done.
I aim for about 50,000 steps a week. I do about 7,000 a day.
Yeah, you're not meaning it then, are you?
Yeah. I'm 12.
Oh, nearly, yeah.
Yeah. I'm 12 stone, having lost 5 stone. And I'm less than 18% body fat and I have a six-pack. But I do have a belly that bloats, so I guess we all have our imperfections.
It's very modest of you to say that. I'm going to come out and say it's increasingly seeming to me you do have your imperfections, but I'm not sure they're necessarily related to or limited to your belly that bloats. I'll be honest, I am feeling at this point I don't want to engage with any more conversation with you, but please do tell me what happens next.
I meet my PA, Helen, at the local harvester for breakfast, bacon, sausage, fried egg.
Did somebody come up to you and ask if you were Adam Smith from the podcast and you made them have a book with your autograph in it?
No, but people do come up to me and say, I didn't expect to see you here. Look, they do grilled chicken.
What are you doing in my garden?
Yeah, look, they do grilled chicken, there's a salad bar, and I've never been disappointed in a harvester. It's all about expectations when it comes to food. I don't know if you think this, but I've regularly been disappointed in 3-star Michelin restaurants all around Europe, but I've never been disappointed in a harvester. So I have my harvester breakfast, I manage Smith & War Recording, I manage my wellbeing business, and now there's also my new health and wellbeing podcast as well, which is called A Piece of Cake.
Stupid title, isn't it?
I love a bit of cake.
Cake.
Yeah, and I love chatting to experts, but you know, I'm quite the expert too, having been journaling, manifesting, goal setting and reading self-help books for years now.
You sound insufferable. Would you like to hear about my perfect Saturday?
Not really, because I'm a colossal narcissist.
Well, I will just tell you, in the afternoon, because I'm an amateur literary scholar, I spend 2 hours by myself looking at Bronte merch and cottagecore on Pinterest.
Don't care.
Was all of that.
That was my Saturday.
Try again.
It was an elaborate parody of Greg Wallace's virally appalling Saturday.
That's right. So we're going to start by talking about that because, well, there's a double layer, isn't there? Because it was kind of an affectionate parody of you and your breakfast that have become such a feature of Sawtass over the last, the last few months. But also because, yeah, he did this, like, just every line's a zinger of all of the dickish things he does all Saturday, or claims to do, which is arguably worse. And that people were satirical about it, weren't they? Lots and lots.
Yeah, you know, he is right about Harvester, though. I mean, because
I know, but that's like saying I've been disappointed by posh hotels, but I've never been disappointed by sleeping in a ditch.
Well, which is my philosophy, isn't it? Like, I never stay in nice hotels. I always stay once.
The reason
I think
you wouldn't be disappointed by staying in a ditch is because you know it's horrible, and then it is. Like, that's not a good life.
That's true, but there is like a consistent standard at these like a harvester type outlet. Also, no Swiss breakfast in a harvester either.
Mm-hmm. No, it's sausage, bacon, and fried eggs.
And
a PA called Helen.
Absolutely fine. I mean, imagine if every hotel you went into was just like a harvester breakfast.
If every hotel you went into was a harvester breakfast and Greg Wallace was in it.
That'd be worse. But it's like if every hotel you stay in has a harvester breakfast, you're always going to have a reasonably good breakfast, and it's going to be good, not a Swiss breakfast.
Well, it's interesting because he says he has sausage, bacon, and fried egg, and then he goes on about chicken and salad bars. So, don't know what he's actually really doing in there.
But, no. So, did you have any thoughts about it?
I thought it was just casually hilarious. So after he's had his fry up at Harvester, he goes straight home for soup that his beleaguered wife has to make him. He casually drops in that he plays with his son for an hour and a half, but he didn't want to have that baby.
Yeah.
And he let his wife have the baby, but demanded that they had to have a holiday without him every year and that the mother-in-law would have to move in to help.
Yeah.
And then because he's a history... What did he say? An amateur historian, so he goes to play Total War Saga for 2 hours every afternoon. Then he makes some fish for the family, and then he goes to bed at 8 p.m. And this, I think this is like one of the most annoying lines, actually. He ends by saying, "I've tried sitting on the sofa eating biscuits, but I don't find it fulfilling. We read or watch a film on my laptop. I'm normally asleep by 9. It's like, it's not the sign of an elevated sensibility. No. Like, "Oh, I don't find it fulfilling. You are like to watch a stupid telly." Like, just how is it more fulfilling to watch a film on your laptop and be asleep by 9? Like, that's objectively not better.
Well,
is
I think
it?
What he means is I don't do like communal television watching.
Yeah.
Like, I don't, like, so his wife's there
watching a film on his laptop.
Well, he's watching it on his laptop. She's presumably just entertaining herself.
We read or watch a film on my laptop.
That's very strange.
I bet he has it more like over towards his side and she can't really see it.
Yeah.
And it's angled so that she can't actually see the images.
Yeah. Yeah, when it first came out, I thought this might be a satire because he did the
you very charitably said, didn't you, like, "Oh, well, he did that meat thing, so maybe it's a satire." I don't, but then everyone else started tweeting like, "I've met the guy, he is
yeah." Well, so my tweet was basically, don't forget that he did My Miracle Meat, the Britain's Miracle Meat in the summer, which is a modern version of A Modest Proposal, and it was done as a hoax, and he had to set himself up, blah, blah, blah. But then as the tweets came out and everyone's like, "No, he did this to me, he did that to me, he's like this, he did that, he did this," I suddenly thought, oh, no, it's not.
Yeah. And it almost made, I mean, presumably he didn't write that meat thing. Maybe he wasn't even in on it.
He did write it.
Oh, really?
That's why I was impressed by him, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I guess it's because he's a history buff. Yeah. So he must have been like, "Oh, I'll do this Swift thing now."
Do you think that comes up on Total War Saga? I don't know.
So that happened. But then a few days later, he wrote in like the Telegraph or something.
He was like, really saddened by it all. Yeah. And he does love his child after all.
Yeah.
The two tweets or X's that I saw that most kind of corroborate the idea that he wasn't trying to be funny or satirical than he is. Guy who speculatively tweeted him and said, "Would you support my cancer charity, Greg?" But he failed to put on the frankly stupid third G in his name anyway. And Greg Wallace just replied, "G?" And then the guy replied and said, like, "Fuck off, master twatties. People with cancer, but you just worry about your second G."
Yeah.
And then a woman who'd worked with him, whose name was Mimi, I think, and he said, "That's a stupid name, I'm not going to remember that," mocked her all day and called her UU instead of Mimi. And it's like, I don't know. I haven't met him. I've never liked a single thing he's done except that Miracle Meat.
I didn't
like him on MasterChef.
No, I've never seen MasterChef ever. I've never seen a single episode of MasterChef.
And before that, I used to do a programme on Radio 4 that was about vegetables. And it would just be like, "Oh, we're having leeks today. I'll put butter on them. I can't find out with a bit of butter there. Oh, look at that." And it was like,
I can't look at that. It's radio.
Well, yeah, who thought these ingredients, Greg Wallace, talking about vegetables and saying that they look nice and taste nice, would it be good anyway, let alone on radio? But yeah, it was very poor.
Some weird radio stuff. I was wondering those kinds of things. Like, you know, there's the garden one, isn't there, on a Sunday?
Gardener's Question Time. Yeah.
And sometimes they'll be on location in a garden. Mm. And I'm like, are they though? Because you could just, like, when they do any kind of vox pop thing, it's like, I hope they've not gone to the trouble of actually standing in Paris, because they could just do this with ambient noise.
But I did enjoy... That is one of their worst offerings, to be fair.
Gardeners. I mean, I've learned a few things when it's come on by accident, but generally it's insufferable for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a garden, so there's not much point in that.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy some of the memes. In response to this,
there was this. Like, I liked the Sims one where he's playing on his Total War game and the baby's on fire on the floor.
I particularly enjoyed that one. I liked that someone just did, like, "How's your Saturday?" And he said, "I wish I didn't have my child."
And every line could be Partridge as well. Yeah. Could it be meeting my PA Helen at the harvester? Got a little scam going with a bigger plate.
Yeah.
Yeah, going to the gym early. Partridge does that, doesn't he, in the Christmas special when he makes them open Rumbelows for him.
Yeah. Like, it was a tweet that really started. Like, I'd love to have been the person who did the initial tweet. Someone just tweeted the picture of the article and said, like, "I can't believe this is real" or something. And it was that tweet, really, that was the thing that went viral, wasn't it? More than the article itself. But
Because, I mean, the article, it was in the Telegraph, wasn't it? So if it wasn't for that, only, like, a selective few elderly Tories would have seen that anyway.
Yeah.
And probably didn't know who Greg Wallace was. But now everyone knows who he is and that he is kind of a dick.
Yeah. And it doesn't, I mean, the fact that he's come out and done this thing, like, "Back off, stop picking on me," article suggests to me that he wasn't satirising celebrity culture, like he just walked straight into this and is perhaps, yeah.
Do you know what I thought next week? I bet whoever was queued up to be my Saturday in the Telegraph the weekend after was like, could I just have a look again at that copy that I sent?
Yeah, yeah.
Just make sure there's nothing like utterly cringe and appalling in it or pulling out, and that whoever they're approaching to do the upcoming ones will be thinking twice or nay thrice.
Well, this is the big thing I regretted about doing that tweet suggesting that it might be a satire, was that someone replied to it and said,
it's not a satire.
Don't you just feel awful for his autistic son or something like that?
And
I
was like,
well, I do, yeah, I do. If that's, if it's, yes, I suppose it would be an unlikely thing to do satire about, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because he says so, like...
He plays with him in the garden for an hour and a half or something, doesn't he? And it's like, I mean, I assume he's got quite a big, nice garden, but it sounds a bit dismal, especially as it was, like, early February.
Yeah.
It's just like, run to the fence, Sid. Run back. No, we still got 87 minutes, Sid.
Well, that was one of the memes, wasn't it?
Do the run. I never wanted you.
2 minutes. That was one of the memes. It was, like, 2 minutes... 59 minutes past two... And like Greg was playing happily with his son, like 3 o'clock, the son's on his own, he's just playing on Total War.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Mm. Lovely stuff.
Very good, yeah. Is that everything we want to say about Greg?
I think
Greg Edgar Wallace?
Yeah, yeah. What is this podcast?
Yes, we should, yeah. What is this increasingly unthemed podcast? It is the podcast, there is the podcast of Smith and Moore Talk About Satire, the podcast in which I, Joe Waugh, and you... So,
Adam Smith.
Talk about the form, function, future, and history, and present,
and the and total, future. The Total War saga of satire.
Oh, very good. Yeah. So I might change the name of this podcast to Total War Satire. Mm.
Satire semicolon the Total War saga, spelt W-A-U-G-H.
But how is that better than Total War W-A-U-G-H satire?
That's what I said, isn't it?
No, you said a load of stuff about colons.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. It should be called the Total War Podcast.
Based on that intervention, I think it should, yeah.
So it's a bit of a different episode today, isn't it? Because it is...
Because it's utterly formless.
Well, yeah, but also it's February.
Yes.
Which is our satireversary month.
Yeah, so we've been doing this for...
Don't say it out loud. Don't say it out loud.
Can that be true?
I don't know. Is that true? It was.
It is true.
Is it February 2019?
Yeah, because it wasn't February 2020, was it?
No, yeah. So February.
Because we'd already been doing it for a good while when all of that shit happened.
Wow.
I know.
5 years.
5 years.
And literally dozens of listeners all these years later. No, it's it's true. And like some people say, it's quite nice, actually. There's a lot of Johnny-come-latelys on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like people, there's been multiple phases of this, isn't there? Waves of people, I'm doing a podcast now, and then it doesn't really last. There's been it doesn't.
No other podcast than this has ever lasted more.
But I've noticed, I was at a classic Adam anecdote. I was at a conference the other day at the University of York. We were talking, and I think someone said... I come to your Smith and War events at the festival every year, the York Literature Festival every year, and then we talk about that. And then someone else was like, "And Adam's got a podcast with Joe Waugh." And then someone goes,
"This is why I'm going to call it Total War Saga."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
More apparent.
So,
with help from Adam Smith.
Adam's in a podcast, and they were like, "Oh, you've got a podcast, have you?" And you sort of see everyone rolling their eyes, like, "Yeah, everyone's got a podcast. Everyone thinks they're a podcaster these days." And then when I say, like, "Yes, we're coming up to our 60th episode," suddenly it is legit. It's like,
it doesn't make it legit just to keep on doing it for year after year when no one cares.
I have an honest belief. I've been thinking about this for the last couple of years. If you want to succeed in life or have an enriching life, just do something for a long time. Like if you've got absolutely nothing going on, just pick something. It could be reading books. And just read them from start to finish. If you just read one book from start to finish, you've got something to talk about, you've got something to think about, you'll be fine.
You could read that Russian book by Amor Towles that Greg Wallace mentions, couldn't you?
If you just talk about satire once a month with a dear friend,
you
will be a better person, I think.
Yeah, I'm surprised that anyone would come to those events but not have heard of the podcast, because we do bang on about it quite a lot, don't we?
Oh, I think they had heard. I think one person was saying, "I come to your events,"
person.
And another person was saying, "And there's a podcast, isn't there?" And then
because I was thinking, like, maybe we should name drop it more at the event, but I don't think we really could.
I think the event is called Smith and Moore Live, isn't it?
Smith and Moore Live brackets. They've also got a podcast.
So because it is that momentous occasion, we are just going to mostly today talk about a piece of satire each that we're very interested in, like very much, but have never mentioned in all the episodes
we've
done.
Well, I think we've both mentioned both of them lots of times, in but not in as long form a way.
We've never done a deep dive.
A deep dive, yeah. Okay, but you wanted to say something about AI didn't you?
I did, yeah. Mm. So I will say, but just before we do the AI segment, AI is a very interesting thing.
Yes,
with a lot of serious implications.
Yeah.
Well, that's a matter of opinion.
No, I'm being silly.
I've not seen
anything good come out of it apart from endless funny pictures.
And I suspect that, you know, when life as we know it has been fully restructured by the interventions that AI is making, we won't be laughing about it. However, at this point, I think it's possible to generate some very funny things using AI, isn't it?
I think we'll be laughing on the other side of our slightly weirdly shaped faces where the eyes never come out right and there'll be sort of odd words around our heads when AI has taken us over.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm doing?
I do, yeah. Anyway, but we can talk about our adventures with the Microsoft Image Generator in just a moment. But there's, you know, the people... So John Holmes, who makes The Skewer, and also Unsafe Space, which I adore.
Yes, yeah.
Has a new sketch show on BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds called We Force a Bot to Write the Show. Now, I don't know exactly how this works, like, in terms of how they produce it, but the conceit,
it says, we take the scripts, push them word for word into the mouths of actors. Yeah, we forced it to digest massive amounts of human media and write its own versions. Fed it basically everything, and then got it to write a script.
This comedy conclusively proves that AI is an absolute idiot. Mm. Now, I've listened to the series. I don't believe them. Because I don't think this is weird enough, actually. Some of it's really weird. But some of it, like, I don't know whether they get the scripts out and then workshop it a little bit. But there's bits where it seems like, because they're all comedians who do it. It feels like they're trying too hard to make it funny or, like, to make it sketchy. Whereas my experiences with AI is it's just much, much weirder.
I've never seen AI, even on very strong encouragement, manage to be funny.
Yeah.
So the jokes were like, knock, knock, who's there? Adam Smith. I've got a podcast. Would you like my autograph?
That wasn't AI generated. That was real.
Yeah. No,
yeah.
So you think it's not fully true that so it's a conceit that they've given it to AI.
What I suspect, I mean, I love John Holmes. If John Holmes wants to come and talk to us about this, I'd be fascinated to know how they do it. And it could just be that it's real. What I suspect happens is they type the stuff into AI, they give it the corpus, it generates things, and then I just suspect they workshop it to smooth it out and make it a little bit more accessible because, like I say, it's not weird enough. But that said, there are it's a sketch show, so some of them are better than others. Some sketches are better than others. But when it's at its weirdest, it sounds like Chris Morris wrote it or something.
Right.
So I've got an example from this episode. So the prompt that they've given it is they want it to write an advert for the army, an army recruitment advert.
An army recruitment advert.
Exterior, day. Battlefield of the Drizzle War. It is raining as to look miserable. Wet soldiers peer out of some river with their guns aimed at terrorism.
Soldiers aren't born. They're made out of toast and a bald egg.
A helicopter fires a flag at a place that looks foreign. The flag explodes and the foreign place learns about politics.
Do you have what it takes? It takes courage. It takes determination. It takes resolve for indigestion.
We see pre-soldiers a training of the most basic. They climb ropes. They pull ropes. They shoot at ropes. Ropes are clearly the enemy.
It takes guts. It takes going to army.co.uk and clicking the join button.
To prove the army is not just about killing ropes, a lady is shown using a computer. This proves that anyone can do army, and there are more than one skill. She is emailing a hand grenade to a foreign place with un-Western politics. It works well.
The army is strength in numbers. Only numbers. Letters are bad. Letters are the enemy, like ropes.
In the dark, some camouflaged soldiers of all kinds of diversities are in a wood. They jump into a foxhole to hide. The fox does not want them there. It is too bad for the fox.
Army people are full of training.
I think you're right. I think they have... there's some bits of it that sound like what AI would write.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, but when it says... It takes courage, it takes determination, it takes resolve for indigestion.
That's a very good
like,
four
that's
joke,
mixing,
isn't it?
Yeah. So I think they've got some funny stuff out of it.
Yeah.
But the things about, like, they're sending a grenade to places with un-Western politics, I sort of I could kind of see that.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's it. Well, the funniest bits is that, and then also army people are full of training. Like that kind of those kinds of phrases are good. But yeah, so that's, you see what I mean? Like, I'm not 100% convinced that it's purely AI generated, because I think
I don't think it could like shift tone to comic effect in that way, because you can't say like, please intermittently do some bathos to AI.
Well, you maybe can. Maybe that's what they've done.
You can, but it wouldn't be able to do it.
Well, maybe that was the prompt. It was like, do an advert, like watch all these army advert videos, make a script, now make it like appealing for Radio 4 audience or something like that. But I thought I wanted to mention that one in particular, because I think this shows like how this is satire is that, like, on the one hand, it's trying to make the point, the jokey point, that AI is an idiot, and I'm sure there's many people who disagree with that. But it's using the conceit of we made an AI to draw this to do this to draw attention to the like the problematics of an advert for the army.
Yeah,
which is something that we've seen in our own experiments with Image Creator, which is that like it because it's drawing from this corpus and we can't understand its logic, but it throws up attitudes that are worthy of satirizing. Like, for example, me and a colleague were doing this the other day. If you ask it to do an academic, it gives you loads of men. Like, if you just purely say,
I know that. Do you mean the colleague was me? Because no, I did that too.
Yeah, I know you did that. And then, but then we said, do an English literature lecturer.
Yeah.
And it gave us a sexy woman in a cardigan eating a cake, like by a blackboard surrounded by books. And then we said, do a geography lecture, and it gave us a man again, like a ginger man, in fact.
Yeah. So like, when you say students, they're usually attractive young women. Yeah. But when, because I did that one about a group of academics are in a pub making bad puns, and they were all just like grey-haired old gentlemen, and they made the pub like a university library as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really, you have to say female if you want it to do a woman, or else it just won't, unless it's like child or student or something like that.
But that's exaggeration, isn't it? Like, it's exaggerating these trends. So I'm not saying that the image generator is doing satire, but we can use it for satire.
Yeah.
So there's one other thing before we move on from AI. I mean, did you have any funny stories about using AI image generator that have made you laugh?
Well, they were just all quite amusing, weren't they? Like the one where I did the one about decolonizing the curriculum, and it was a load of like students with weird shaped faces and one eye missing, holding up placards that said things like "Storties matter" and "Die Lockenockenismus die Curricula."
Yeah. Well, I thought something that we've had that we have experienced over the last 5 years actually is that it's quite hard to think of images to use for like events and things. So
I see you made one of the satirical Brontes, didn't you?
I did, yeah. That was interesting. Because then, so I made it and it had the Brontes as clowns, and then it had these weird gothic pictures of the Brontes surrounded by crows. And when I told my dad about this, he asked ChatGPT why an image creator would do those images. And it said that it was to do with the themes of absurdity in the works of the Brontes.
Well, that proves AI is stupid then, doesn't it? Because it's taken that question and been like, well, I'm sure AI had a good reason, so it'll be because there's themes of absurdity, but there aren't themes of absurdity.
Well, then I said, where are the themes of absurdity? And it's like, Catherine's affection for Heathcliff is absurd. Like, she takes love to an absurd
level. But it would have said that about it. That's like when you give an essay title and you can see when something's been bent to it. It's like, if you'd been asking it, like, why did you do doves because they symbolise peace? It would have said, because Catherine's relationship with Heathcliff ends in peacefulness.
Yeah.
Like, it would do it no matter what, and there are not themes of absurdity.
Yeah. But it is hard to come up with an image that represents the act of satire. And we ultimately, nowadays, we just use the photograph of us, don't we? But so I asked...
Which itself must be 5 years old.
Yeah, I was thinking that the other day.
We're not getting new ones.
Well, I was thinking if I knew I was going to have to look at that picture for 5 years, I think I would have been depressed. Yeah, because it's not the best picture of me. It's a great picture of you, but it's not the best picture of me. Anyway, so I asked Microsoft Image Creator AI to do an image that represented the act of satire.
Okay.
And it gave me 4 results.
So a man is looking in a mirror. His eyes are widened and his mouth is agape. And he's saying, I am a work of art.
It's good, that, isn't it?
So that reminds me... of some discussions in seminars this week about hailing, and we got way down a rabbit hole about looking in a mirror and if you speak to yourself, are you hailing yourself, and are alarm clocks hailing? But maybe we could have a maybe we can find a way to discuss those things on another episode.
Well, that links to the Matrix, because he goes through the mirror, doesn't he? Puts his hand in the mirror and goes straight. But yeah.
Okay, so I am a work of art.
And he's got like big goggly eyes, and he's got like clown makeup on, I think, hasn't he? He's got like clown blush on his cheeks. But I thought he's holding up a mirror to mankind, which is what satire does, isn't it? The satire is a mirror that reflects what you don't want to see. So I quite like the aesthetic of that one.
A man is looking, maybe not in a mirror, maybe a portrait of himself, because the size is different. He's got his hands in his pockets and a sort of Edwardian style moustache, and he's saying, I am a work of art. I'm going to assume
He's saying, I am work
of art. Yeah, sorry. I'm going to assume you didn't ask it to only do men.
I didn't,
but
no.
It just did.
The prompt was literally an image representing the act of satire.
Right.
So I didn't say anything about art. I said the act.
Men act and women watch. Mm. Mm.
But you're right, it is a portrait, because they're in a gallery, I think, aren't they?
Yeah.
So it's like he's looking at a painting of himself and he's thinking, I am work of art. Which he literally is. There's a painting of him.
A man is looking in a... I think this one is a mirror, but it's distorted.
It's like a fairground mirror, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's saying, am I work art?
He's invented a new letter there. Am work art. So he's a bit more like a hipster, this guy.
Oh, you're reading it as an M? I thought it was two A's squashed together.
Yeah, okay.
It could be, well, it's not really anything, is it?
Work art.
Am I work art? Yeah. Am I? And then this one is more clowny. He looks a bit like a snowman, doesn't he? With his red nose and his red cheeks, he's saying, I am a work of art.
And he's got four eyes for some reason.
Why has it got hung up on this thing about a work of art and portraits?
Portraits, mirrors, work of art, I don't know. Yeah. I think it's like satire is a mirror that holds up a reflection to mankind, and then there's the art element.
But it doesn't hold up a mirror to the satirist, does it? They don't hold up a mirror to themselves and say, I'm a work of art.
Yeah. It is interesting to me that it keeps doing clowns whenever I touch. Because when I did do Satire and the Bronte, it made them into clowns. And I think it must just be we don't know. This is like the interpretation of dreams from Freud, isn't it? Like, we're learning more about ourselves from how we try and make sense of these things. But I wonder if it's just a synonym thing, like satire, comedy, clown. But maybe that's too simple. We don't know how they work. Anyway.
Yeah, and that's what it will have done with Catherine and Heathcliff. It will have gone extreme, exaggerated, passionate. That's sort of the same as absurd. There are themes of absurdity.
Yeah, and a symbol for absurdity is a clown.
But that's not a theme of absurdity. That's a judgment that it is absurd. But it's not a theme of absurdity.
A theme.
Yeah, stupid.
anyway,
okay,
that's AI.
That's AI. Yeah.
You do the next one.
Don't you want to do Gulliver's Travels?
No, we can come back to that. Well, I've just done an item, haven't I? And then now it's your go.
Yeah, well, I'll try not to go on and on and on for ages, so there isn't time for you to do your thing.
That's fine, I don't mind.
So we said that we'd bring some things that we like, didn't we?
We did.
I thought about Three Men in a Boat, but I think I've talked about that quite a lot on the podcast. So I'm going to talk about George and Weedon Grossmiths. That's a good name, isn't it? Weedon Grossmith.
Yeah, did you? Yeah, maybe Grossmith had been stung by a jellyfish.
They're both called Grossmith.
Well, the one
George's
who got
Weedon.
Maybe the one who got Weedon.
I think it's probably pronounced Weedon. Let's not get bogged down in the whole weeing. It's a book called The Diary of a Nobody from 1892. And it is one of my favourite and funniest books. And I am in very good company in that opinion. Evelyn Waugh called it the funniest book in the world.
Is that our relation?
That's right, yeah, Auntie Evelyn. They read it out loud in Brideshead.
Oh, right.
And do the voices and everything. Augustine Birrell in the 1870s said that Charles Pooter, you'll like this, ranks alongside Don Quixote as a comic literary figure.
Oh, wow.
And someone else said that he was like Don Quixote as well.
That's so interesting, isn't it?
Somebody else that we like.
When I was reading Pickwick Papers, people kept saying that Mr. Pickwick is a Don Quixote character as well.
Yeah, like maybe people bandy around Don Quixote a bit too much.
Well, it's in... listeners, we've just taught Jane Gardam's Crusoe's Daughter on a module. And they keep saying that the old man... I've forgotten his name, so I'm tired.
Mr. Thwaite
keeps being described as being Don Quixote in stature. So you could say he's Don Quixote, his tall Don Quixote figure.
Yeah.
I mean, and that is a chaotic or quixotic narrative. Mm. But anyway, we digress.
Yeah.
He's a good lad, Don Quixote. I like him.
Yeah. And do you know what's interesting about Augustine Birrell, who said that about Charles Pooter?
No.
Do you know what else he did? A biography of Charlotte Bronte.
Ah.
Yeah.
It's all connected, this literary canon, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The Wars, the Brontes, the Diary of Zimmer Nobody. So...
Yeah, I think the canon's great.
I don't think this really is the canon, but it is a book that a lot of people love. So it's it was originally published in columns in Punch.
Ah.
And then the Grossmith brothers were, they were also actors, and they wrote this, and then they put it together in a book, and it was it's had like a loyal and dedicated following ever since. And I like this story about I think it's Whedon, when he was an actor, the actor Henry Irving was directing him and said, like, what you've got to do is just copy me and then you'll be doing acting right. And he, I think, said it was a misunderstanding, but what he did was just do an impression of Irving. So he was like parodying him on the stage, and he very nearly got fired from the production because he was being insincere.
What a mistake to make.
But anyway, The Diary of a Nobody is the story of Charles Pooter and Carrie Pooter, but it's narrated by Charles. It's his diary. It's the kind of everyday suburban life of this sort of slightly... He's a real stock figure in British comedy. It has lots of, as John Wilde in The Guardian suggests, that his kind of literary descendants are, and sitcom descendants are, Adrian Mole, Bridget Jones, well, only because it's a diary, Captain Mannering, Victor Meldrew, Alan Partridge, David Brent, Peep Shows, Mark Corrigan, and I think most of those are entirely apt as comparisons. So the story just goes through like a year or so of Pooter's life, and the sort of just nothing much ever really happens. He's got a disappointing son who keeps going out to get drunk, and then he comes back home and dances around his room, and then he's hungover in the morning. He is always sort of, I don't know, he gets a line that I really like is that he gets invited to the mayor's ball, and he's really excited about it, and he buys two ties in case one of them should spoil in the tying, which I just think that's something I often think about, that like, I'll buy two new pairs of ties in case one should spoil in the wearing. I'll read some of my favourite bits in a moment, but it's a book that I've loved since I was about 15, and that I think in amongst people who've read it, there are lots of quotable quotes and recognisable character types as well. So one of the things I like it, because it's a Victorian text, but it's one of those Victorian texts that should remind us that people don't necessarily change as much or in the ways we would predict. Because he has about six hangovers that are described in painstaking detail through the text, for example.
Yeah.
But what has changed is that his life in Holloway is very... The thing about it that's disappeared is that the neighbours come round virtually every evening, and what they do in the evening is... Mr. Going and Mr. Cumming, who are Pooter's two best friends, just come round and they play cards and they play games in the parlour, or they'll do a bit of singing, with one bit where they try and have a seance. And sometimes they'll just bring round other people and just say, like, oh, I've brought him this evening for an evening of yours, I hope that's okay. And there's one who comes around called Mr. Padge, who turns up every night for a week, takes the best chair and won't get out of it, and doesn't kind of speak or contribute, and every time anyone says anything to him, he goes, that's right. I think we've probably all like encountered a Padge or two in our time. As John Wilde in The Guardian says, for many of its hopelessly smitten devotees, unconditional love for Doughty River Nobody is the true measure of a person. A fair few acquaintances of mine unashamedly admit they cannot seriously consider a friendship with anyone who does not find the novel uproariously funny. One close friend actually goes to the lengths of using the book to vet possible girlfriends in order to test whether their sense of humour is in working order. Rare is the Pooter adherent who doesn't return to the novel at least once a year. Countless are the Pooter groupies who own multiple versions of the book. I think this is why I've never quite wanted to put it on Victorians, and instead I do Three Men in a Boat, which I like, but not as much, because I wouldn't want to have to start hating them all if they didn't like it. That would just be too difficult. One of the things that Charles does is makes a lot of like lame puns, and then he'll sort of laugh uproariously, and the one time he makes a pun it doesn't go down terribly well. And then he like he wakes up twice in the night shaking with laughter at how funny it is. And, like, and so, for example, he's outside gardening, having picked up a good book about gardening, and he says, "I procured and sowed some half-hardy annuals in what I fancy will be a warm, sunny border. I thought of a joke and called out Carrie. Carrie came out, rather testy, I thought. I said, 'I've just discovered we've got a lodging house.' She replied, 'How do you mean?' I said, 'Look at the borders.' Carrie said, 'Is that all you wanted me for?' I said, 'At any other time you would have laughed at my little pleasantry.' Carrie said, 'Certainly, at any other time, but not when I am busy in the house.'" I just loved the fact that the way that he's forced her to come down like three flights of stairs so he can say, like, "Look at the borders." I'm actually nervous talking about it in case everyone's listening to it and thinking that sounds like a shitty boring book. But well, not nervous, but I feel like it's hard to do justice to it.
Well, do you know, I've not read it. But and I didn't read Three Men in a Boat, and for years I had this tiny suspicion. It was like, I wonder if it's not actually that funny. And we just kind of go, oh, because they're doing comedy in the olden days, it's quite funny. But it's like reading a stand-up routine. I read it at Christmas. Yeah. I'm going to read this now. I read Three Men in a Boat. And it's just, it's like joke, joke, joke. Yeah. And like what you say, like there's a real, and I get this with my 18th century stuff sometimes, there's a real nice connection between you and the people in history when they're making like jokes about things.
Yeah.
Like the being Three Men in a Boat when he goes to the doctor because he's basically hypochondriac. And the doctor just says, go for a walk, have a pint of beer and eat a pie and go to sleep.
Stop reading things you don't understand.
That's it, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was really tempted to like bring some snippets from that as well, but I thought I'd just try and keep it to this one. But yeah, just like some things haven't changed all that much. And you're right, in Three Men in a Boat, I think there were legacies in stand-up of that kind of meandering anecdote and observational comedy, but also in the sitcom.
You don't need to be nervous because you were right about Three Men in a Boat, so I think you'll be right about Diary of Nobody.
Yeah, I just, another bit I really like is when he stops off on his way home from work and he buys several tins of the new Pinkford's enamel plate, and he goes home really quickly and he paints some flower pots, and they look quite nice and shiny. So then he goes up to the servant's bedroom and paints a washed-down towel horse and chest of drawers, which the servant isn't pleased about. On his way home the next day, he says, "Got more red enamel paint, red, to my mind, being the best colour. Painted the coal scuttle and the backs of our Shakespeare, the binding of which had almost worn out. April 27th, painted the bath red and was delighted with the result." And then he paints his friend's walking stick. He just keeps buying paint on the way home. Went home early and bought some more enamel paint, black this time, and spent the evening touching up the fender, picture frames, and an old pair of boots, making them look as good as new. I love the kind of childish joy in just painting everything with his paint that he buys every day. And then all the paint in the bath comes off and he thinks he's in that Marat picture because he holds up his arm and it's like dripping blood, so then he has to
That's like something that you can see, that's like something Homer Simpson would do, isn't it? Just like get addicted to painting things red.
I determined not to say a word to Carrie but to tell Farmerson to come on Monday and paint the bath white. So the paint's really funny. Just little details, like he goes on holiday and he's really excited because he's brought a straw helmet, and there's a picture of it which is also really funny. And his son Lupin, who's like 19, won't walk down the pier with him because he's wearing an embarrassing hat. And as you say, like moments where the Victorians seem relatable, like who hasn't been like, "Dad, you're not going to wear that. Like, I'm not walking with you if you wear that." And when he like, this is the final bit I'm going to read out loud, and then I'm going to tell you about the game. So Carrie has a friend called Mrs. James who is always into every like faddish new fashion, and Charles doesn't approve of her, and she gets into seances and she wants Carrie and Charles to do a seance with her. I said, "I'm very sorry, Mrs. James, but I totally disapprove of it, apart from the fact that I received my old friends on this evening." Mrs. James said, "Do you mean to say you haven't read There Is No Birth," which is a fictional version of a book called There Is No Death, which was about the kind of fad for seances, and there's a lot of knowledge in this book. I said, "No, and I have no intention of doing so." Mrs. James seemed surprised and said, "All the world is going mad over the book." I responded rather cleverly, "Let it. There will be one sane man in it at all events." Mrs. James said she thought it was very unkind, and if people were all as prejudiced as I were, there would never have been the electric telegraph or the telephone. I said that was quite a different thing. Mrs. James said sharply, "In what way, pray, in what way?" I said, "In many ways." Mrs. James said, "Well, mention one way." I replied quietly, "Pardon me, Mrs. James, I decline to discuss the matter. I am not interested in it." I just love that as like you've lost the argument.
Yeah.
I often think of that. "Pardon me, I decline to discuss the matter. I'm not interested in it," as a kind of translation of what people are saying when they've lost the argument. And finally, I just wanted to tell you about, there's a moment when they're on holiday and their friend says, like, "Oh, let's play the game of cutlets. I'll sit on this chair, you sit on my lap, then you sit on their lap, then you sit on their lap." And then he says, "Are you a believer in the Great Mogul?" And they all have to shout, "Yes, oh yes," like four times. And then the guy at the bottom gets up and they all fall on the floor and Carrie breaks her nose on the fender. Oh. And apparently this is sort of a satirical version of a real Victorian parlor game, which I thought we could play right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, yeah.
So what happens, in theory, we would, there would be more of us, we'd be lined up, this is in the footnotes, on one knee, kneeling on one knee with the other one raised, twiddling your thumbs on the raised knee. And so each person in turn has to say these lines, and when it's your, it's a bit like I went to the shop and I bought, you have to say all of the ones that went before as well.
I see.
Do you get it?
Yeah.
Right. So I'll take you through it as it goes. So, "Well, friend, and how art thou?"
Hast thou heard of brother?
No.
No.
You have to say that.
Oh, "Well, friend, and how art thou?" What am I supposed to say?
Oh my
sorry,
God.
Sorry, no, don't. Sorry. "Hast thou heard of brother?" Oh, I get it. Okay.
Right.
So I repeat and then add a bit on.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. "Well, friend, and how art thou? Hast thou heard of brother Obadiah's death?"
"Well, friend, and how art thou? Hast thou heard of brother Obadiah's death? No. How did he die?"
"Well, friend, how art thou? Hast thou heard of brother Obadiah's death? No. How did he die? With one finger up. Stop twiddling thumbs and hold up right forefinger."
"Well, friend, and how art thou? Hast thou heard of brother Obadiah's death? No. How did he die? With one finger up and one eye shut. Close your right eye."
"Well, friend, and how art thou? Hast thou heard of brother Obadiah's death? No. How did he die? With one finger up and one eye shut and shoulder all awry. Do that."
Put your shoulder awry. "Well, friend, and how art thou? Hast thou heard of brother Obadiah's death? No. How did he die? With one finger up and one eye shut and shoulders all awry. How did he die?"
"Well, friend, and how art thou? Hast thou heard of brother Obadiah's death? No. How did he die? With one hand up and one eye shut and a shoulder all awry. How did he die?
In this way. And what you do then is the person at the end of the queue barges into the one next to him because you're all on one knee. Everyone falls over and hurts themselves.
Right.
Which sounds like a really lovely game, doesn't
it? It does sound good. Yeah.
Yeah. If a little long-winded.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if there was like 12 of you doing that and you all had to say how art thou every single time?
Do you make up different things every time?
So that's no, I think you always say this. That.
Oh, okay.
So really, there'd only be a shock value in it the one time, wouldn't there?
Well, I suppose it becomes a memory game, but like it gets easier the more times you do it.
Yeah.
Who's Obadiah?
I think just a fictional character like Lucy Lockett or something like that in a game.
I quite like how morbid it is.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. It's a very strange way to die as well, isn't it? With one finger up and one eye shut and shoulder all awry.
Yeah.
And then being pushed over.
Yeah.
It'd be funny if someone did die playing that game, wouldn't it?
It would be. Yeah. So in the book, the character breaks her nose playing a similar game.
Yeah. When they play "Are You a Believer in the Great Mogul?" There's a picture of it. Look.
Yeah.
And then they all fall over.
Yeah. Another example of timeless comedy that I remember from that I would think about all the time ever since I read Three Men and a Boat is whenever you pack your bag, you always need,
always at the bottom.
And it's this toothbrush, isn't it? Mm. Like, yeah, you have to unpack it all and pack it all again. Like, yeah, good. I'm looking forward to reading Diary of Nobody. That's
cool.
Great.
Well, I've got three copies, so.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I'd love that. Yeah.
You can have one of them.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I don't think I've really done it justice there, but I think, it's just. Just a very charming, comforting, and often very funny and relatable book. And I just love the image of him running around painting everything shiny red in his straw helmet.
It sounds from the extracts you're reading, it's important that it's a diary as well. That's part of the comedy.
Also partly why it was serialised in Punch. Yeah. So in that way, the comparison with Bridget Jones is merited.
Mm.
And that's it, also, I didn't know this, but there are various points in the book of it where it seems like it's about to end because he'll say, like, "I'm not writing my diary anymore because this has happened." And then what's happened is Punch have like asked them to do some more, so they have to. So then the narrative will kind of restart again.
Mm.
And there are bits where like. He'll lose his diary for a bit and think, like, be accusing everyone from the butcher to the ironmonger to the boy who delivers the fish for to of having stolen it or burnt the pages out or whatever. Mm. So yes, it is important that it's a diary. Yeah.
Cool.
Okay. Do you want to talk about Gulliver's Travels?
Yeah. So my text was Gulliver's Travels by Jonathan Swift, and it's interesting that that's perhaps a diagnostic parody of the diary form. Like, it's playing playfully with the diary as a form, is it?
I don't think it's parodying the diary as a form. It's using the diary as a way to express the kind of quotidian, mundane reality of life. Like, the diary, the fact that it's like 27th of April, bought more paint, 28th of April, bought more paint, that's a structure and a strategy for humour, rather than that it's mocking people for keeping diaries or the form of the diary,
okay.
I would say.
Well, that's different.
I hope that
then
doesn't completely ruin your point.
No, I was just trying to make a segue, but it doesn't work.
That's okay.
Well, I was going to say that Gulliver's Travels is, like, there's lots of things it's doing, but one of the things it's doing is it's a parody of travel writing. Like, it's making fun of travel writing from the period. But yeah, Gulliver's Travels is a novel I read a long time ago.
If you want a parallel for that, I can do you one.
Yeah.
Three Men in a Boat started as a travelogue, and then he increasingly found that he was being funny, and that it, so that's why there are some odd lingering bits where we talk about landscape.
There's an amazing bit where he's standing outside looking at the stars, and it's just the most, like, evocative and, like, genuinely moving description of, like, what it's like to stand in the at the night outside your tent looking at the stars. And then it just goes back
it's
into, like some
Harris
comedy.
Fell into a puddle or something.
So this was, a parody of travel writing in one way. But there's lots of things going on. I read this a while ago, and then I've read it again recently. I taught it for the first ever time this year, and I'm writing a guide to it for Audrey Reads.
Yes.
As you are.
Of which I'm doing of three and a bit.
Yeah. So, so I spent
not
a bit more time.
Yet.
Yeah. But, like, one of the things that really struck me re-encountering this novel again, and this is far from an original observation, is, like, how it's a bit like, you know, no one ever adapts Frankenstein properly. Like, no one ever does Frankenstein as the novel. The novel is a critique of romanticism. It, like, never happens. Like, there's the fact that the creature, when he first runs away, sits in a cave and reads Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
Like, that never is in any adaptation.
He reads, like, The Sorrows of Young Werther, Paradise Lost, and something else.
Yeah.
Is it just the Bible? No, is it Shakespeare?
Yeah.
He has a little stack.
He does, and he reads it, and he's like a book talker. Like, he reads them, and then when he learns to speak, he just wants to tell everyone about like his own fan casting ideas of how he would fit into Paradise Lost. But that all gets left out, and there's a similar thing going on with Gulliver's Travels in that, one, and this is similar to Jane Eyre, we were talking about this the other day, weren't we? That it gets bolderized for kids immediately. Gulliver's Travels does, and I think the similar thing with Jane Eyre. What was that?
Bowdlerized.
Is that how you say that?
It doesn't
that?
Get made into a boulder, does it?
Bowdlerized.
Yeah, I think
okay.
so.
Okay, yeah. And so, and all the kids' versions adapt the first place he goes, which is Lilliput, which is an interesting bit. But then all the films, I'm only aware of one screen adaptation that does the other bits of the book.
Mm. Is it because they're all boring?
No.
So they've taken them out?
No, I think
being Philomena Conqueror, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I don't think it is. I think it's because they're too harsh. They're horrific. Mm. Like, the implications of them are not pleasant. Because basically, so there's loads of different ways to read the novel, but I think one of them is that, so Swift goes out of his way to fashion himself as, like, a misanthropic character, like a cynical misanthrope who hates, a hater of mankind. Gulliver isn't like that. Gulliver's kind of like, he believes that everyone should be free, he's open-minded, he's anti-colonial, like, he's all of these things.
Is his name meant to suggest the concept of gullibility to us?
I think perhaps. Like, I never thought of that. Right. But he is, like, a little bit, he puts politeness first, and he's always open-minded, and that helps the narrative, because he befriends basically almost everyone. But his kind of his own self-cultivation and his consideration of himself as this gentleman explorer is constantly undermined by the fact that he needs to have a shit or that he needs to piss. Like, all the time, like, there's so much detail about when he needs to go to the toilet, how he's going to go to the toilet, and that's a problem when he's a giant.
Would have been unheard of in those days, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. Mm. But it's a problem for him when he's a giant, because he produces a vast amount of fecal matter, and it's a problem for him when he's small, and it's a problem for him when he's on a boat, and all this stuff. So he's constantly being undermined by the bodily functions. But then if you read the whole book, the final volume, where he ends up...
a nice big poo.
Well, no.
It feels so much lighter.
Well, he ends up in the land of the Hurnims, which is how you're supposed to
horses.
Say it. The horse people, the horses, who live opposite these characters called the Yahoos, who like are...
Aren't they quite racistly written?
Well, they're written as... There's some bad drawings of them.
Words like savage bandied around and stuff.
They are like, well, they gnash their teeth like savages. Mm. They flick shit at each other. They're hairy. They hang out in trees. They are motivated purely by lust and greed. Mm. And the humans can't understand why they are so interested in shiny objects.
You're quite
and
good at that noise, aren't you?
Yeah, that's how you have to say it.
Yeah, no, I believe you, but yeah. I don't know if I could. Yeah,
I was in a yeah.
A very horsey man. Well,
they loved it when I did it in the lecture, but yeah. I was like, it's an attempt to represent difference. But anyway, yeah. So yeah, and then
did you then climb up a tree and flick shit at them?
I didn't. Not to, no, but no, that was the Huonims. They're convinced. The Huonims. That's how you do it.
Yeah.
The Huonims, most of them are convinced that Gulliver is a Yahoo. But so what I was going to say is that everyone Gulliver meets, he has an open mind, even when they're quite different from him, generally speaking. But he has this visceral, repulsive reaction to the Yahoos.
Mm.
Like they're monstrous. He's horrified by them. He's repulsed by them. He wants nothing to do with them. And then, of course, the gradual revelation is that they are us. Like, so humans, Western humans are the Yahoos, and the Yahoos are humans in their natural state.
Right.
So if you take away government, political authority and all this stuff, like, this the Swiftian idea that they would... It seems that Swift has this idea that we're all just animals dressed up as something else. Like, not just nice animals like a parrot, but like these barbaric, degenerate things.
If we're all nice animals dressed up, nasty animals dressed up as something nice... Like, that's fundamentally paradoxical, because we wouldn't dress up as something nice if we were all nasty animals. What?
Well,
just do that.
Yeah, well, his sort of thesis, as I understand it, is that it doesn't take much to scratch away, to reduce us to that. So we're not that, but we're easily reduced to that. And all the places that he goes, because Gulliver's really happy to be English, and he goes to these different countries and he explains, like, this is how we do things in England, and we have the legal system, we have this, and we have that. And everyone he meets is like... But what about this obvious problem with that system? Mm. Like, that's never going to produce equality, or that sounds like vanity to me. So Gulliver goes on this journey where he basically discovers that all the values that he held are, like, motivated by vice and vanity and the hunger to acquire, and that Englishmen are a kind of vermin, basically. And it's capped off by him meeting these Yahoos, who are this ghastly version of a kind of Englishman, or a kind of human. And then he comes home and chooses rather to live in his stable with his horses than with his family. A bit like Greg Wallace. He doesn't want to spend any time with his daughters. He wants to sit in the stable with his horses because they're more decent and reasonable.
What a fucking stupid man.
What's that?
To do that, obviously.
What would be the better thing?
I think to not live in a stable and instead live in the house with his daughter, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, well, he has to.
Even if he's got to play Total War Saga all afternoon.
Well, because he spent years with the Yahoos and the Huonims.
So now he should be happy to be with his family.
Well, he's become acclimatised to the stench of... He's come to understand the stench of humans as the stench of Yahoos. So when he goes home...
Get over yourself.
He can't bear to be around his daughter and
his
wife because they
pathetic.
Stink. Yeah. But that's not the end of the book. So,
oh, good.
It is the end of the book. But the end of the book is actually the start of the book, which I had forgotten about in this. So it begins with a note from Gulliver to his cousin, Simpson, saying, can you please tell the publisher these things? Like, these are the things that people are going to object to. And the conceit is that it's 5 years since he got back. He's written it all up. And he has to explain why, if he believes that humanity are all Yahoos who just want to get fame and fortune and aren't actually interested in genuine self-cultivation, why has he felt compelled to write this down?
Yeah.
And he admits it's because he's a Yahoo as well. So over the 5 years, he's sort of come gently to terms with the fact that we are Yahoos, but that's not, like, that's going to happen. So there is some kind of hope for a kind of reconciliation or rehabilitation towards the end of the story. But so that's the main bit of it. But in the middle, he goes to all these other places. I know you said, do we not talk about them because they're boring? But I think, like, Brobdingnag, where he's little, is really interesting because he basically gets treated like a slave. And then volume 3 is called A Voyage to Laputa, Balimbarbi, Lundag, Glubdadrib and Japan. So that
sounds
he goes to lots of different
IKEA
places.
Shelving unit.
He does.
Satire.
Well, that's like that. He goes on a flying island. He meets loads of different people. That's like full blown sci-fi. Mm. That section.
It's I presume that Lewis Carroll must have been thinking of this when he wrote Alice in Wonderland. Yeah, being small and all that.
Surely so. I hadn't considered that, but yeah, surely so. And what I was going to say
is Adventures in Wonderland. Apologies.
But no, something that the students picked out that I hadn't really clocked that is genuinely really funny is that he keeps going home. Like he does, so he gets back from Lilliput and he goes home. And then after a few years, he's like, I need to go on another journey. Because so basically he's a failed doctor. Like he's not a very good businessman. He's not very business savvy. So he gets his income by going on these journeys as a ship surgeon.
Right, okay.
So, but it also conveniently means that he can leave his family for years at a time.
And the ships always go to these sort of weird, unreal places.
Well, something always happens that leads. So like when he goes, so Lily puts a shipwreck. And the thing the thing about that I'd forgotten until I was doing it in some detail is that when the ship is about to be wrecked and he realises he's going to have to swim to the shore, he has a pint of bitter before he jumps in the sea. And then like when he's, you know, the scene where he's...
Beer blanket?
Yeah. Well, that's what he says. He literally says that. And then the famous scene where he's tied on the beach with all the little people climbing on him. Like what you don't get in the adaptations is he needs to piss for the whole time because his bladder's full of beer. Like they're just things like that you don't.
This is the thing, isn't it? Like all of this, like it would have been unheard of for, and you know we're so much more like liberal and cool, and we're not like ridiculously abashed by notions of propriety in the way that stupid olden days people were. But it's the 20th and 21st century ones that take out the thing about needing a wee.
Yeah.
Like Swift's fine with it, his readers are fine with it, but then adaptations in the contemporary moment have not been comfortable with it.
Yeah, that's it. And then he goes
think
on.
Think it through.
Then he goes on another voyage, and this time they get taken over by pirates, and he gets marooned on an island. And then, so basically, he keeps going on these voyages. Things keep happening that involve him discovering another island, and then he goes home for like 3 months, and then does it again. And that is quite funny. Like I don't know if it was meant to be.
Is it because he just doesn't really. Like why does he have it that way?
Why does Swift have it that way?
Yeah, I guess.
Are there
just to sort of double down on the compulsion to travel?
I don't know. It's interesting. So like the 1990s adaptation of this, where it's the guy from Cheers, who's in A Good Place, plays Gulliver. I've forgotten his name. Ted Danson. Like they do it as a kind of Homer's Odyssey type thing, where Gulliver is gone for like 20 years, and he just leaves one island and goes to another island. That actually makes more sense.
Yeah.
As an odd, but like no, and I think every time he comes back, he's like more and more disenchanted with his life in London as well, and then has to go again on another adventure. It's not quite the novel that you expect. There's genuine horror in it. There's a lot of scatological stuff. There's a lot of laugh out loud comedy. There's a lot of observational comedy that I never realised until I was going through it in this level of depth for this Audrey Guide thing, and it's just I'm just really appalled actually. On behalf of Swift, that it got balderized and made so basic, and that and it actually would make a really good like prestige drama TV show, I think, like 10 episodes, sort of Game of Thrones level budget type thing.
Except you could probably do it even with the Philip Pullman type level budget, couldn't you? What was it called? You know, all of that.
Yeah, not his Dark Materials.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So do that, please, BBC. Do that. Do like a
next time you want to do another one of Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
Do that.
Do actual Gulliver's Travels.
Yeah.
And have it as nasty and as comic and as dark as the book is. And and basically, I just hope that people will read it actually, and because I think they'll enjoy it. And also, sci-fi people, like you'll enjoy this.
And do you know what though? I would say BBC. I don't mind if you don't make a dramatisation of The Diary of a Nobody. I don't think that it would work, and they'd only cast David Mitchell in the main role, and it would never be like quite right.
No.
So have Martin Jarvis read it out loud on Radio 4, which for all I know you perhaps already have done, but don't worry about making it, but do spend it on Gulliver.
Anyway,
well, you look like you've got a bit you want to read there.
Just one final thing I wanted to say. So an interesting thing happens on our degree in that students encounter Jonathan Swift for the first time in the context of The Lady's Dressing Room.
Yeah.
Which is a complicated poem, but is easy to read as like horribly misogynistic, and it incurred the wrath of Lady Mary Montagu, as we've discussed previously in the podcast. And it means that, like they said things to me this year. Like one student was telling me that she, whenever she sees a Jonathan Swift book in the bookshop, she has to just like stare at it and shake with anger and rage at what a horrible bloke he was for writing The Lady's Dressing Room and things. And then they read Gulliver's Travels, And it's got things in it that you just wouldn't expect if that was your only impression of Jonathan Swift. Like, for example, this. And I'm just going to finish with this because... Okay. So at the end of the book, he's saying... and you're perhaps wondering why I'm not going to tell you where these places are. Like, why don't I tell you where the land of the Húnims are? And why don't I tell you where Brobdingnag is? And he says this. He says, I have a reason for not telling you this. To say the truth, I have conceived a few scruples with relation to the distinctive justice of princes upon those occasions. For instance, a crew of pirates are driven by a storm, they know not whither. At length, the boy discovers land from the topmast. They go on shore to rob and plunder. They see a harmless people, are entertained with kindness. They give the country a new name. They take formal possessions of it for their king. They set up a rotten plank or a stone for a memorial. They murder 2 or 3 dozen of the natives, bring away a couple more by force for a sample, return home and get their pardon. Here commences a new dominion acquired with a title by divine right. Ships are sent with the first opportunity, the natives driven out or destroyed, their princes tortured to discover their gold, a free license given to all acts of inhumanity and lust, the earth reeking with the blood of its own inhabitants, and this execrable crew of butchers employed in so pious an expedition in a modern colony sent to convert and civilize an idolatrous and barbarous people. Mm-hmm. So he's like, I'm not going to tell you where it is because colonizers are going to destroy it. I love that line. Like, the earth will reek with the blood of its own inhabitants. Like, we're going to go there and sack these people, and that's not okay. And then, so suddenly they're presented with this like anti-colonial, anti-racist, like. Seemingly progressive.
I suppose you can be anti-colonial and anti-racist and be misogynistic, though, can't you?
You can, yeah.
Owen Jones.
Yeah. No, you can. But then there's bits in the... I'll stop talking about Gulliver's Travels. But like, one of the things that Gulliver's quite taken with in Lilliput is that the girls and boys get the same education.
Mm.
And Gulliver actually says, why on earth do we condemn our girls to a life of sewing when these girls in Lilliput can do everything a man can do, short of running as fast? And that's so like
it's, how lovely.
But then that's not Swift, it's Gulliver. I know it's complicated, but like, it just don't judge people on the basis of like one thing that they did that you read in a specific way. Like, people, it's about like we were saying about history all through this podcast.
Yeah,
like, it's much more rich and nuanced than you might expect.
Absolutely, don't judge people. The old days,
books.
What else is there? Anything else you shouldn't judge? Should judge Greg Wallace, I think. Sorry to sound mean, but...
Yeah. That's an interesting full circle, though, because maybe we shouldn't judge him on the basis of one interview that he gave.
No, although, but I think that's the point. Everyone's judging based on
everything else he did. Yeah, fair enough. Fair
everything
enough.
Everything he's ever said and done. Yeah. Do you need to say anything else?
No, well, I...
I've been doing this episode for 5 years now.
I really enjoyed talking about George and Weedon Grossman and Gulliver Smith. And Jonathan Swift with you.
Yeah. Talking about them, less so saying their names.
I suppose what we should say, actually, is that our event at the Your Literature Festival will probably happen before the next episode comes out. So if you want to come and see us live, you can do that.
When is it? March?
It's
something
in March.
Like the 17th or something around something similar to that sort of business.
Yeah, just Google. We're so well prepared.
We're not going to do all the work for you.
What is it? It's the 19th, isn't it? Is it the 19th?
No, it won't be the 19th because 22nd is a Friday. So it will be the weekend before the 23rd.
This is great listening.
Yeah. Yes, all right, we will spoon feed you and hold your hand. It's on Sunday, the 17th of March at 2 o'clock. And we'll be talking about the Brontes and we'll be talking about Sartre and we'll be trying to connect those two things.
Yeah, and it's in the Creative Centre.
Auditorium, York St John University, Lord Mayor's Walk, York. Do you want to say it together? YO 31
7EX.
And please do enclose a stamped addressed envelope. So we can return your pictures.
And and that's free, but you do need to reserve a spot, and there is only a limited number of tickets left. So if you do want to come, book your ticket now. It just says a limited number when I went
because
on
it. Because it will be limited, won't it?
Yeah.
Because there's only so many seats.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you should reserve a spot for sure.
Yeah, wicked.
Yeah.
We're going to have a good time, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to have a good time.
Talking about Saturday and the Rotates.
Yeah. We better think about what we're going to do for that, haven't we?
Yeah, we've thought about it. We just need to do it now.
Yeah. Have a little practice. Is there anything else? Any other news? Anything else you want to say?
Maybe it would be a good idea for people to buy the novel Burnham Wood and start reading it.
Yes.
Because we've got a special thing in the future, haven't we?
Yeah, hopefully so. So yeah, why not buy that?
Really easy to get hold of because it's like really doing well. And if you go into Waterstones,
it's the main one near the Tills. They've got it on a little stand. Or if you today they have, but they might not for long. So hurry on down.
Yeah. Burnham Wood by the author of that book.
Eleanor.
Eleanor, yeah.
Yeah, by Eleanor. And yes, so you might want to read that. Well, next time we'll presumably do something about women, I guess, because it'll be Women's Day. Or we don't have to do a Women's Day episode, do we?
No, we don't get enough.
We might have said enough about all of those olden times Marys at this point.
We never do an episode that's just about men, do we?
No, from Greg to Gulliver to Grossmith, it's been all about the lads.
That's the title.
This one, all about the lads. Yeah.
One year after our episode, what about the gals? We've got all about the lads.
Yeah. So, I think that's everything.
Yeah.
Do you have any more on this?
Well, no. Just please do give us a yell.
Yeah.
Satire@gmail.com.
Yep.
Or at Talk About Satire on Blue Sky or Instagram, or at Satire No More if you're still on Twitter or X.
So Instagram is which one? Talk About Satire?
Talk About Satire, yeah.
Okay.
It's Talk About Satire everywhere except the Twitter, because we made the Twitter when we had our conference, so that's got the...
Yeah, of course. So yes, you can yell in any of those places if you want to, and have a lovely time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Joe, and happy Satireversary.
Yes, indeed. How will you be celebrating your anniversary?
I'm going to read some satire.
Okay.
And then I'm going to give you a yell about it.
Okay, good.
Well, how are you going to do it?
I'll be sitting up.
Oh, yeah, I'll be shutting up.
And I'll be eating our satire, I should think.
Eat our satire.
Eat it up. Bye.
Bye.